Welcome, Action fans, and thanks for joining us for another edition of All 90s Action All the Time, as we continue our journey through the 90s filmography of Kurt Russell. I'm one of your hosts, Scott Murphy, and on today's show, we are talking about Escape from LA. And who do I mean by we? Well, that is a bit more complicated than normal. So, you may remember Kyle from Season 1. Unfortunately, he is still out on his Casey Ryback-style adventures. You may also remember Craig, who is my regular co-host, but unfortunately Craig was there 1 minute, but then I turned my back for just a second, and just like the crow, suddenly he has disappeared. So, struggling for options, I was forced to throw up the 90s podcaster bat signal, and one man rose to the occasion, and that man is co-host of the Namely 90s podcast, Mr. Brandon Schwitter. Hi, Brandon.
Hello, that's me. I saw the signal and I raced to my 90s mobile to get here in time.
And I'm so glad you did, because otherwise the listener would have to listen to me talking about the whole plot of Escape from LA just myself. And I feel like that wouldn't be as entertaining a show.
I would listen to that, but it depends on how loyal your listeners are. And I feel like they are, but it's always fun to come on and ask to be on a show that's also set in the 90s, so that I can put my 90s knowledge to use. Because if you know anything about our podcast, my co-host never knows anything about anything in the 90s.
That's one of my favorite things about your podcast. I love that fact.
I'll pass that along to Andrew. For me, it's more frustrating because I have all of this information both in my head and research done, and then it's just like, nope, never seen that. I'm like, thank you for participating. Sorry, I derailed us already.
No, it's all right. It's totally fine. I totally recommend. I mean, like, at the end of the episode, you can give all the social media details and plug the shit out your podcast and your Patreon and all that stuff. But at this point of the podcast, I would also recommend our listeners to check out your podcast, because it's a lot of fun. And I love Andrew's lack of knowledge of the 90s. I love you doing the BuzzFeed quizzes. I love Jules' poetry. It's all good.
We ran out of her 90s poetry, so we're looking for ways to reincorporate that into the show. But yeah, we had a stretch in the last 6 months, because I for Christmas I gifted Andrew Jules' book of poems from the 90s called, I think it's A Knight Without Armor, and he would read in the middle of the podcast. Just her poetry changed my life, because I didn't realize there could be bad poetry until I read it. We love Jewel, but there are some doozies.
Yes, and having listened to them, yes, they are definitely some fun, some doozies. Yeah. On to today's film, Escape from LA, was released on September the 20th, 1996, which means it is celebrating its 25th anniversary of this year. It was directed by John Carpenter, who I'm sure everybody listening to this knows who John Carpenter is, but normally I read out the notable credits of the director of the film that we are covering, so I'm still going to do that. So his notable credits include, as you may know, The Thing, They Live, and Halloween, and of course, Escape from New York. It was co-written by Carpenter himself, alongside Deborah Hill, who produced a number of his films, as well as a number of other films, and was the co-writer on Halloween, Halloween 2, and The Fog with Carpenter. And finally, the last credit on the script was Kurt Russell himself, which is his sole writing credit. Critically, the film didn't do so well. It is currently sitting at a 5.7 out of 10 on IMDb, 53% on Rotten Tomatoes based on 51 reviews, 54 on Metacritic based on 21 reviews, and it has a 2.8 on Letterboxd. And it did even worse at the box office, because it made a paltry $25.5 million off of a $50 million budget, making it only the 78th biggest film of 1996. And to be fair, as much as this film is not a masterpiece, genuinely, and it was beaten out at the box office by some truly terrible films. So at number 77, you have the terrible, terrible Kelsey Grammer submarine comedy, Down Periscope. At number 72, you have the rubbish Leslie Nielsen spoof, Spy Hard. And at number 70, you have the disaster that was The Island of Dr. Moreau. The fact that all of those films beat it at the box office, still mystifying. But anyway, Brandon, tell us about your relationship with this film and why you wanted to come on the podcast to talk about this film.
Well, first, the option to be on the podcast was presented to me, and I looked at the films from Kurt Russell from the 90s, and I was like, well, Captain Ron's not on here and Stargate's not on here. But I recognize Escape from New York. I've watched Escape from New York. Escape from LA. Wow. I've already done that.
it's okay.
And that's the one that I could probably speak most intelligently about, for these episodes. And, so I jumped on it, and my relationship with this movie is I was flipping through channels, as either a teenager or a 20 something. And, I thought either Escape from New York or, Big Trouble in Little Chinatown was on TV, and I was watching it. I'm like, this doesn't seem familiar. And then I realized it was Escape from LA, and I caught it from probably one of the maybe 5 to 15 minutes into the movie. And I watched it. I'm like, this is terrible, but for some reason I rather enjoyed it. Kurt Russell, was reprising his role from Captain Ron, clearly, with the eye patch, and not Escape from New York. and I've seen it a few times since. It's a go-to for when I'm just like, I want to watch an action movie. I don't want to watch one that's super serious, but also takes itself way too seriously. I don't love it, but it's from the 90s, and the 90s has a treasured place in my heart, having grown up there. So there's just so much going on in this movie that it's hard to just condense into a single reason why I jumped on this.
Yeah, that's fair enough. And we will further explore that as we explore the plot. And as always, I don't always remember to do this, but in these episodes, we do explore the plot from beginning to end. So this is your official spoiler warning. If you have not seen Escape from LA, please go and watch it and then come back and listen to this episode. That's what I'd recommend you do. But you have been warned. So if you go any further and then complain about it, that's just ridiculous. I've given you your warning.
Yeah, I believe Kurt Russell comes and smacks you upside the head if you complain about a spoiler warning for a 25-year-old movie.
I think that's maybe what happens. Yes, if you do complain about it, Kurt Russell will come to your house and pistol whip you. That's in character. As Snape Plissken.
Yeah, he'll have one of those futuristic 2013 pistols that the two that he has in the movie, and just hit you upside the head. You may get a concussion, but legally you've stated that you accept it because you have gone past the spoiler warning and are still complaining.
We may as well get into it. Brandon, can you tell us how this movie starts?
Yes, I can, Scott. In the far off future of 1998, 2 years from 1996, when this movie was released, Los Angeles is a immensely crime-ridden and crazy hellscape, apparently. Although in the film, while this voiceover is going on, they just show a regular street of cars and whatnot. But what happens is there is a giant earthquake, which I think they said in August of 2000.
It was 2000 it happened.
I don't know why. I don't know what I don't know why they needed to first set the first part of the film in 1998, then immediately skip forward a minute later to a massive earthquake. It was, oh, I do know why. It was to set up, sorry for all of you new to my style of storytelling, but I am very non-linear when it comes to explaining things. It was to set up that the president of the United States was a very religious man for some reason, and he was claiming that in 2000 there would be a massive earthquake that would be our day of reckoning if we don't repent. And it happened. It happened. And the San Fernando Valley floods, Los Angeles becomes its own island. It's, you know, the plot of, I believe, the first Superman movie. It's like if Lex Luthor actually managed to have that happen.
Yeah.
Except instead of making new real estate, which, again, I don't understand how that would be. Oh, beachfront property. Never mind. Instead of making new real estate for himself, they erect a giant wall around the new border and create a... essentially a new Australia for history fans, where they just send despots and the sinners from America to the island of Los Angeles. I don't know if I'm explaining this well enough. It's
yeah, no, that's all explained. That's all. The one thing that I will interject is you said he is religious for some reason. Apparently, the character of the president was one of the things that was written by Kurt Russell, and he wanted to make a spoof of televangelist Pat Robertson, which is why he's religious in that way.
That makes sense. But I always thought Pat Robertson, for me, being, I live on the West Coast, so most televangelists now live in like the Malibu area of California, LA area. And it's mm-hmm. just like all the super mega churches are broadcast from there. So back in the 90s, you would find the televangelists more from the Bible Belt region of America, which is why I was a little thrown off. Also, the president becomes elected for life. I don't know how that happened. And, if you were to picture him in your mind, you would think back to, the previous president of America, the current previous president of America. And he has the exact same hair if it was a little bit more chestnut colored.
That is true. Like in some ways, this movie is oddly prescient.
Right. I halfway through, I was like, is this a parody of Ivanka and her father? Like, is this, were they trying to see the future, or did they see the future and just get the events wrong? but yeah, so during a terribly, terribly, terribly CG moment, you see the earthquake that splits Los Angeles, and they call it the City of Sin, which I thought Las Vegas was. And there's some CG buildings that fall down. But first, their windows completely shatter by just completely falling out of their thing. It looked, yeah. I'm going to be honest, this intro, I thought it was an episode of Sliders, given the visual quality.
Oh, that's good. That's the kind of deep cut 90s that we're looking for on this podcast.
I mean, just like this was a theatrical film, and that the computer graphics budget was not great. Although again, it was 1996, so it looked like it was a made for TV movie at times. But that also could be because I was watching it with I was watching it on Amazon Prime. And I used a free subscription to Stars to watch it. And so I don't know the version you watched. Was it in 16:9 or was it in like a proper film ratio?
I watched the same version on Amazon Prime here.
Okay.
That we should clarify that this episode not sponsored by Amazon Prime.
not a sponsor. But that was the easiest way for me to watch it. I would have had to wait until Tuesday to record it when I was on TV, but it was just, It looked like it was a TV show, just given the way it was presented to me, the way I was watching it. So.
Yeah, to be fair, we will definitely talk more about the visual effects. And one of the fun facts that I learned while researching the film was apparently the people who did the visual effects on the film, Buena Vista Visual Effects, had never dealt with computer graphics before. And also, this was the last movie that they worked on.
I am shocked, very shocked to find out that was the, I wonder if it was because they did such a terrible job, or if it was because of, like, my grandmother in the 90s stopped working and retired because she didn't want to learn how to use a computer. So there's.
Oh, you think they were like just a practical effect shop and they were just like, you know what? This is not for us. If this is the way the world's going, we don't want to be in it.
Exactly. Cause if you look at the practical effects, they're bad, but they're not terrible. It's not ILM by any means, but the scale models were on par with, I would say, the practical models from Independence Day.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah. No, like, I think most of the practical effects are fine.
Yeah.
We will discuss further some of the shoddy, like, the CGI is one of the worst aspects of this film. And the CGI is so bad that it does become distracting at many points during the film.
That and their lack of understanding the layout of Los Angeles, which I bring up multiple times. So we don't have to stop on it here because we haven't even gotten to 2013, which is where the movie is actually set.
Yes, that is correct. And also, I love when you get like a title card that is like one of those screen readouts that are like hyper specific for no reason. It's just like LA Friday 1900 hours. You're like, cool. Glad I know that now.
The 1900 hours. I was like, okay, but. I guess they can, a running thing through the movie was time and time running out. It was just, why would you need to know it's 1900 hours when eventually there's a running clock on your protagonist? Cause yeah, I guess we should get more further into the movie before we discuss that.
Yeah.
So finally, 2013. Actually, no, I want to go back before we even get to this.
Before we get to Snake's arrival. Okay, yeah.
Because you mentioned title cards, and I was like, the actual title cards in the movie was like 2.5 minutes long, and it looked, again, this Buena Vista clearly did not know how to do computer graphics, but it was just like, they were trying to make it look digital, I think, or they might have used digital graphics, but it was just like, a bunch of names in the middle of the screen, and then like a tiny green border around the outside. And I was just like, why are you making me sit through 2.5 minutes of this? they didn't just do like starring Kurt Russell and the numerous amounts of really good cameos and small guest parts in this movie, but it was like written by, directed by, and I'm pretty sure it went into like just the really nitty gritty stuff in the intro of the film. I'm like, this isn't a 1940s film. You don't have to put the entire end credits in the intro. Just get us to the movie. It was a black screen with a single name and a green border. It's not engaging in any way at all. Sorry.
It's a totally fair point. It was a lot of credits at the start of the movie with nothing happening, and you're just kind of like,
did movies build in buffers for people coming to the movies late back then that I just don't remember or have like cleansed out of my mind? There was no reason for that.
No, I think, I mean, it's quite an old fashioned thing, you know, like, I mean, I know Carpenter's a big fan of like Westerns and stuff. So like, you know, he's just an old fashioned guy.
There were a lot of Western influences in this movie, so I guess that's probably it. I mean, yes, it was probably similar titles to Halloween, but that's like a 2-decade difference, if I remember my time.
Yeah, no, it's true. Yeah, Halloween came out in 1978. I want to see. And yes, so nearly.
So in 2013, back to the movie, I'm sorry. Yeah,
going back.
In 2013, a man named Cuervo Jones, played by I believe a Greek actor.
He is a French actor with this again, you know, this movie's like the ethnicities of some of the characters don't naturally match up with that of the actors. So he is a French actor with Greek origins, and his name is George Corifus.
Very 90s casting for ethnicities, for ethnic people in this movie. He played Cuervo Jones, great name. And he
is not given a nationality. He's just said, oh, he's South American. Ah, that covers a lot of territory, but thanks, Phil.
but he definitely put on an accent for it. And, I have here he was a part of the Shining Path Peruvian Revolutionary.
Okay.
Revolution, I guess. But there were like four or five different Central and South American countries that were coming to attack Miami. Which I will get to in a second. He seduces the president's daughter, whose name is Utopia. And she, via a holographic system, and she's brainwashed into stealing her father's remote control for the Sword of Damocles, which is a satellite grid around the world, some sort of super weapon. I believe at one point they referred to it as a mega neutron bomb, but it was capable of rendering all electronic devices anywhere on the anywhere on the planet useless. She was aboard Air Force 3 at the time, and then she, I believe, crashes it into L.A. or uses an escape pod to get to Los Angeles to join Cuervo.
Yes. She uses like a kind of escape hatch in the bottom of the plane. It's interesting in this kind of scene that happens, where Snake is watching this hologram kind of in front of him, and the hologram kind of expands, so he's kind of in the hologram as if he's kind of part of the scene that's happening. And then in the background there's just like a random cameo from Paul Bartel just looking kind of like bemused, kind of like and then he's not in the film because he's credited as congressman, and I was like, oh, that's Paul Bartel, I wonder if he turns up more. No. It's just a reaction shot, and then that was his whole part in the movie.
And that starts the precedent of all of these like big named actors or cult favorite actors showing up in this movie and then immediately having nothing to do or just being wasted with their screen time. And I forgot that he was even in there because it's just a blink and you miss a cameo.
Oh no, it's super quick. Oh, we should also, talking about quick cameos as well, not as quick as that. I mean, literally it is just a reaction shot and he's out, like you'd miss it if you just took your eye off the screen for a second.
Yeah.
There was also a cameo by Peter Jason, who Snake has some banter with, which is quite fun. And he's like a kind of, he's often turns up in Carpenter films. And I was like, oh, he could have been more fun if he
wasn't
a part in the movie.
Yeah. Wasn't he also like a general, he was a military guy, and it was just like, he banters with him the same way he banters with the other military leader, and I was just like, did you forget that you had one or the other character when putting them in? She steals the thing, the MacGuffin that now Cuervo possesses, and he prepares for a allied third world nation attack against the US, or else if the president tries to stop him, he will pull the plug on the country and black out the Capitol. And enter, well, I guess I'm doing this out of order. We see Snake being brought into some detention facility outside of LA. And
which is getting live news reported to some government news channel, apparently.
Because Snake Plissken is known by literally everyone in this country for some reason, or at least maybe it's just all the bad guys, because literally everyone knows who he is when he enters LA. And but yes, she was reporting, there was a news reporter reporting it on television. Did he become super famous? Like, it's been I forget how many years has passed between the first two movies in universe, or the first movie.
So
I guess that was 1997.
Yeah, in universe. Yeah, it was 1997. When it was
Escape from New York.
Escape from New York was set. So like, yes, since 1997, his legend has certainly grown.
So it's been 6 years more or less, and he's been just running around America being a despot. Running guns and doing things and that are later referenced that you think, hey, that would have been an interesting movie or a Marvel comic book leading up to the release of this movie.
Yeah. I mean, it does seem quite a long time, you know, like, because, I mean, it's more than the actual distance between the two films, because it's like it was 15 years between the two films, but like 16 years in universe.
Right. Wait. My brain hurts. 97. Yeah. Okay.
97 to 2013.
Yes. I thought 2003 for some reason. Yeah. So it's crazy that he's still in the public consciousness, I guess. Like, I don't remember. OJ Simpson. I don't remember criminals from the '90s, except I do a show on nineties where we, I think the Mendoza brothers might have been a thing. But yeah, I wouldn't recognize most people by like just seeing them being like, hey, you're Snake Plissken, aren't you?
I suppose it's like the Western thing. It's like the man with no name is just like the legend. Like, he's kind of a legend in the first film as well. Cause like in Escape from New York, everybody's like, hey, Snake, I thought you were dead. And like, you know, so he's kind of always been he's always been a myth.
That's true. It's been a while since I've seen Escape from New York too. And for some reason, I always confuse it for Big Trouble. Until I start seeing the Asian elements, but so he's being brought into the detention center. Like you said, it's being broadcast on national news for no reason whatsoever. And, then he's scratched as he's being brought in down the hallway, and it's like, okay, that was something, obviously. And he's put in an interrogation room, and he's told by the president of the United States. I don't remember who the general is.
It's Commander. Oh. He's called Commander Malloy, and he's played by Stacey.
Commander Keech. Malloy, and then Lieutenant. I looked this one up because it's played by the woman who was Ro Laren in Star Trek The Next Generation.
I recognize her from that as well. She's called Brazen.
Brazen. Lieutenant. Was it Lieutenant Brazen?
She's just credited on IMDb as Brazen. I think in the film it's mentioned she's a lieutenant.
Wikipedia, I think, had it as Lieutenant Brazen. But that's Michelle Forbes?
Yes, Michelle Forbes.
Who people probably know from anything other than Star Trek The Next Generation as Ensign Ro Laren.
But that's like what I recognized her from. I don't know.
she was in like 24. She's Battlestar Galactica. Right. She was in Prison Break. She was a regular on True Blood, I think.
Oh yeah, no, I do remember she was in True Blood. But yeah, Star Trek was the first thing I thought of because
like, same. And because it's so close to that and you're like, why didn't you continue your role on Deep Space Nine that they clearly made for you?
Michelle Forbes, if you're listening, contact us and tell us why you didn't go on to DS9.
Well, she wanted to be in bigger films and go on to better things than get stuck in TV. I mean, not Terry Hatcher. Whoever played Dax on that show did the same thing at the end.
Oh yeah. Oh God. Can't remember.
She wanted to be on, I want to say Becker.
Okay.
Oh, 90s television. Yeah. Definitely not Terry Hatcher. Right. So I'm a bit of a Trekkie.
I am as well. But like, this podcast would end up being 6 hours long if we went too far down that rabbit hole. So
right, yeah, and sorry, we haven't even made it past the first actual scene with Kurt Russell yet. Where do we go from here? So he's in the detention room, and they're explaining the mission to get Utopia the briefcase that Utopia has. Which has the MacGuffin, the Sword of Damocles that he needs to recover, and they reveal that he's been poisoned, and he's like, well, you're gonna have a tough time injecting me with that poison, and then like charges at them, and it reveals that they're holograms. I thought it was clever.
Yeah, I didn't see that trick.
Because I don't remember in 2013 having holograms technology like that.
Yeah, no, I mean, like, unfortunately, no holograms. Just like, you know, everybody was upset when 2015 came and went and we still didn't have hoverboards. It's a whole... Movies have lied to us, Brandon. That's what's happened.
I don't know where my replicant... I want some replicants to hunt down and Blade Run. In 2018, but, don't know where I was going with it. Oh, they're holograms, and, they're like, well, you were already scratched. And it's like, me as the viewer of the movie, recognized that he was already poisoned. I don't know if intelligent is the right word, but as lived as this character is in this universe, seeing as he's not died over the course of 16 years, and previously people thought he died before that, so at least two to three decades of not dying, let's say, when targeted by a person, or when doing crazy stuff, he doesn't notice that he's been poisoned by a random woman walking by. That's some logic breaking stuff for me. The hologram, 2013 holograms, not logic breaking. The fact that he doesn't realize he's been poisoned already.
The fact that he immediately realizes in retrospect that he's been poisoned by that woman he saw in the hall actually impresses the hologram. Well, the president and the commander and Brazen. They're like, yeah, catch on quick. Well, not that quick because like it happened. It already happened.
Yeah. He's clearly bleeding from the scratch. Like there are a lot of Chekhov's gun moments, planted in this opening scene, for the movie. But if you're looking for it, you could probably figure out most of the plot twists, from the start of the movie to the end of the movie, which feels like it's a completely different piece of cinema from the middle of the movie where he's just doing a fetch quest through all of LA.
Yeah.
I believe the president points out that, the people of Los Angeles, it was either the president or, the commander, points out that all the people in LA are either prostitutes, atheists, or runaways, and they're all trash. And it's just like, yeah, that's a list of trashy people, I guess. My notes, I guess I got bored and I wrote, there's so much terrible exposition, except I put some instead of so.
Yeah, we get a lot of exposition at the start of the movie here, but you know, on Snake, on Cuervo, on the daughter, on the president, on the whole LA, you know, like, so I think that's why it's kind of taken us so long to get through this, kind of opening, like, 15 minutes of the film.
It's because
there's just so much, there's so much loaded into these, into this opening section.
And I guess that, although it kept slapping me in the face that, like, it's a lot of Western motifs, like, I mean, Escape from New York had, Lee, what is his name? Not Lee Majors, the guy from
Lee Van Cleef.
Lee Van Cleef. Yeah, he was in that movie, who's I best know him from, The Good and Bad and the Ugly and For a Few Dollars More. So like all the Western stuff was just screaming and slapping me in the face, but I'd never thought to look at it at this movie through that lens. But yeah, it's the intro is setting it up like a very slow old school Western, which I am ashamed to admit that I didn't think about until just now.
Well, Carpenter kind of uses that as a defense of some of the criticism of the movie in terms of it being super similar to Escape from New York, mm-hmm. where he was like, well, you know, Rio Bravo and El Dorado were basically the same film. Just depends on what you like.
Fistful of Dollars for a Few Dollars More and The Good and Bad and the Ugly, all they did was add an additional character and then do the same plot over and over again.
Yeah, but they're still genius though, right?
Oh, absolutely. The Man with No Name trilogy is, those are my favorite Westerns. And personally, I think For a Few Dollars More is the best. Although the best scenes are in, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
Yeah.
Actually, I love all of those. I'm not a huge Western fan, as I discuss, on the Tombstone episode. Those are the movies.
So different.
Those are the movies that I like the most, The Man with No Name trilogy and, those kind of late 60s, early 70s kind of Westerns, things like The Wild Bunch and stuff as well. And also my favorite Western is actually another Sergio Leone film, Once Upon a Time in the West.
Ooh, that's a good pick. And, I don't know if I've seen. Because didn't they remade that? I don't know if I've seen. Wasn't there a remake? Or maybe they just used the name and then replaced it with Hollywood recently. And that's what's triggering my brain. Oh, you mean
the Quentin Tarantino film is very, very different. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, very different film.
That popped in my head when you said that. I'm like, I wonder if that's related to that movie. No, it's not. It's not.
No, they don't none of those films exist in the same universe. I mean, it'd be entertaining if Once Upon a Time in the West, Once Upon a Time in China trilogy, Once Upon a Time in America, which is actually also directed by Sergio Leone, and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood were all existed in the same universe. But they do not.
break your brain. But yeah, I'm sure you talked about this in the Tombstone episode, but the 60s, like the spaghetti Western era, post John Wayne, but like the Clint Eastwood era Westerns are so different from just like Tombstone or Young Guns or any of the 90s, late 80s, early 90s era.
Yeah.
Maverick, which we talked about before the show. There was just something about them that really reached out and made me get sidetracked. I did want to bring up, they tell him he's poisoned. They put a countdown on his arm and then they suit him up. They supply him with weapons and throw him into a mini nuclear powered torpedo submarine thing, that I'll get to in a second, but I wrote in my notes while I was watching him, like they give him the jacket and they give him the fireproof, jacket and, leather outfit. And they're like, you need to wear this whole thing. And then while he's sitting up, I'm just like, did the Matrix steal from Escape from LA? Cause it's very like, it's the black trench coat with the collar up and, a bunch of guns strapped to him. And there's the clipping scenes of him clipping his leg holsters on. And just like, if I was to tell a Gen Z person right now that this was a prequel to The Matrix just based off of the scene, they would probably believe me.
Yeah. Like, I don't, I'm not sure where that kind of aesthetic suddenly became popular, because one of the Stallone movies we covered was Assassins, and in Assassins, Julianne Moore plays a hacker, and that Assassins was actually written by the Wachowski sisters, even though they subsequently kind of disowned the script because it was rewritten by somebody else. But Julianne Moore's character is kind of wearing a kind of vinyl leather jacket, and I don't know when that suddenly, it seems like in the mid-90s at some point, around 1995, that look started to become in, and it was it just continued. It just got more and more as the 90s went on.
I mean, also the outfits and hackers, I think, or
which was also released in 95. Because in the Assassins episode, we discussed that that seemed to be the year of hacking, because Assassins, there's Julianne Moore's hacker in Assassins, there's the Hackers came out the same year, and the Sandra Bullock movie The Net came out in the same year as well. So it was the year of hacking, 1995.
Wow. Windows 95 came out and everyone thought they were a computer hacker. And on top of that, you're a year or two removed from Katie Kirk asking Brian Gumbel, what is the internet? Is it a bunch of wires? Classic 90s, moments brought to you by me, that can't really remember it front to back. But yeah, it looked like The Matrix and I couldn't get past it. And he gets put into a one man tiny torpedo tube, and it's like, it's a submarine that he's controlling, and it's nuclear fuel rod powered. And I'm just like, why do you need this to cross the San Fernando Valley Gulf now, I guess?
They put him in I don't know, because later on there is a helicopter, but it was just going to be shot down if they put him in some sort of flying thing. So a sub was needed.
A rocket-powered submarine, a nuclear-powered rocket-boosted submarine.
Yeah.
I don't think that's how water propulsion works, by the way. Maybe in 2013, but you need some sort of propeller if my time as a West Coaster who had a boat at one point understands how water moved, or my time in college as an engineer.
The terrible CGI a bit more, particularly with this scene. This is probably the worst, maybe the worst CGI in the movie. There is other examples of terrible CGI, but the sub is, and you might be listening to this podcast, dear listener, and thinking, this movie came out in 1996, all of 25 years ago. Of course the CGI is going to look a bit ropey. No. Scrap that from your mind. If you've not seen this movie, the CGI in this film is genuinely some of the worst you'll ever see. I think there's certain bits of the movie, this bit in the movie with the sub, I think the CGI in VR Troopers was better.
Yeah. Wow. That's a bold statement. Seeing as that was a Japanese Sentai type show. But I can see that. To me, it looked like one of those bad, Mario is missing type computer games where.
Yeah, it did look like a kind of bad video game. A better 90s reference would be, the CGI in Reboot was better.
That implies that the CGI in Reboot was bad. No,
the CGI in Reboot was very good for the time. No, I have nothing against Reboot. I apologize to Reboot for even making that comment. I really enjoyed that show as a kid. It was good CGI for the time.
That was the first 100% computer graphics show. But just for reference, Independence Day came out a month prior to Escape from LA in the US. So those practical effects, that CG, Stargate came out 2 years prior, I think.
2 years.
So it exactly what you said, Scott, that erased from your mind bad CG, and watch this because it takes you to new lows.
I think the only other movie that, like, this might be of any kind of major production, this might be the worst CGI of the 90s, apart from maybe Spawn. Spawn also has terrible, terrible CGI. So, like, they're kind of the bottom of the barrel.
For some reason, it was Small Soldiers or Toy Soldiers. The one with Kirsten Dunst.
Oh yeah.
That Joe popped into my head. Yeah, when the toy soldiers come to life, and that popped into my head when you a second ago when you were listing off bad CG.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's I think you're right. It should take an award for the one of the worst, if not worst, CG in movies. Period. Not even just from the 90s. Period.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also during that scene, I laughed because you saw a shark bite at the torpedo submarine thing as he was passing the Universal Studios backlot tour ride sign. I thought that was a good inclusion.
Yeah, that's a good gag. There is some good gags in this film.
But I also thought that must have cost them, seeing as this is a Paramount movie and it was a Universal property.
Yeah. I'm not sure how much it would have cost them, but yeah, it definitely must have cost them something.
Yeah. Or, I mean, I guess you could kind of get away. Later in the movie, they'll get away with saying, oh, it's that place, in reference to a large corporation that probably would have sued the pants off of them if they could have. But for now, he finally reaches L.A., so then he can now escape from it. People are an hour into the episode. Like, he's not even gotten to LA yet.
there was a lot to deal with at the start.
Oh, it's just so much. And now it's just going to be a fetch quest with random cameos that sometimes come back, sometimes don't, sometimes pay off, sometimes most of the time do not. But our first big cameo guest spot, I don't know what you would call this. It's a little bit bigger than a cameo, but it's not really a giant character. Peter Fonda.
Yeah.
I'm sure he showed up for like maybe a day or two of shooting and got a paycheck and left. But I was just like, Peter Fonda plays an old hippie surfer dude. And it's just like, hey, Snake, are you Snake? Snake, are you Snake? Whoa, man. Whoa. And then he's like, oh, it's Acid Rain. And then nothing. Then he's gone.
Also, he has like, so the kind of running gag, there's lots of like equivalents from the first film. So like the running gag in the first film is like, everybody thinks Snake's dead. Mm-hmm. And then, but he's not. And then in the running gag in this film, which is obviously a very Hollywood gag, is everybody thought he would be taller.
Oh, I forgot. I didn't even notice that. You're right. That is a good running gag. That's awesome. I thought he would be taller, which is, I feel like it's true of Peter Fonda, because he looks tall and imposing, but he's not the tallest person, if I remember correctly.
Yeah. But then, like, you know, we kind of discussed this in the Stallone season. Like, you know, I'm, you know, 5'8" and Stallone's like an inch taller than me. And then there's lots of those actors who are around 5'8", 5'9", you know, like, you know, Jason Statham and, like Jean-Claude Van Damme and like, you know, obviously famously Tom Cruise is only like 5'6" or something. Like, you know, mm-hmm. So like, there's a lot of those action stars who are filmed, you know, from
with
the ground
low angle
up kind of thing, yeah, to make them look massive.
On an Apple box.
Yeah.
But Kurt Russell is taller than most of those action stars. He's
5'11". Like 5'11". Yeah. Something like that.
But yeah, you would expect him to be tall. Although Goldie Hawn's short, so seeing the two of them together, you could kind of be like, yeah, he's probably not the tallest person. And then his son Wyatt, I think, is 2 inches shorter than me. 6'2". Who was recently on
Falcon and Winter Soldier.
Yes. I don't know why that was spacing on that. But yeah, I love Peter Fonda. I love Easy Rider. Great movie. So it was fun to see him here playing a stoner surfer, but it wasn't great.
Although from what I know of Peter Fonda, he is basically just playing himself. He is right. An old hippie surfer dude.
This is like either the start or the midpoint of him playing a cameoed weird version of himself. Cause wasn't he in, I want to say he was in one of the Charlie's Angels movies in the early 2000s where he's just on the beach and runs into them. But I didn't prep anything for that, so I do not know if he was or not. But my recollection is there's some movie where he's just like a stoner surfer on the beach and the main character runs into him. And it's not this movie because there's actually sunlight in that movie that I'm thinking of.
Yes, this movie was entirely shot at night. And apparently it was...
on a soundstage.
Yeah. Apparently it was quite constricted, the schedule, because apparently where they were shooting, there was neighbors, and it was, they couldn't shoot beyond midnight, or they couldn't, shoot gun shooting sequences beyond midnight, because there was, complaints. So, it was quite constrained in that way.
That makes sense. It was, I don't know. They used a lot of the 90s, tricks of painting backgrounds and, it looked like an episode of Star Trek The Next Generation, a season one episode, because you could see that the background is clearly fake and, it doesn't go on much past where the actors are, but it also just, didn't look real. It did not look real for most of it, which I guess it's a dystopian hellscape of 2013 Los Angeles. So that makes sense. I couldn't get past a lot of the outdoor scenes.
Yeah, no, sometimes it does look like Snake is walking through a video game, basically.
And again, he says, Peter Fonda's character, one of his last words are, oh man, acid rain, and he puts his poncho on, and then Snake just grunts and walks off with his leather jacket that does not have a hood, and then immediately the next scene the acid rain has stopped. I'm so confused.
Random comment on climate change.
I guess I was expecting in this dystopia that acid rain would actually be acidic instead of normal acid rain that might destroy some limestone. But
yeah, well, it seems like acid rain might be acidic because Peter Fonda has these kind of acid burn marks on his face, but then nobody else does. So it's just true. I don't know, Peter Fonda is just accident prone or something. I don't know. It doesn't make any sense.
It was an actual sunburn from being surfing too long during the day.
Yes. Yeah,
sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to move on to something that this film does better, which is some of the action sequences. So we'll kind of race through some of these scenes because they don't really add up to much. Snake first visits, he kind of wanders through a bordello because one of the rescue team that was sent out and all got killed. Apparently one of them's still alive because they're still tracing the guy's heat signature. But then Snake finds this guy in a bordello and everybody's using him as knife throwing practice. So he is very much dead, dead, dead. And then there's a random guy who's like a knife thrower guy who really doesn't take to Snake. And, you know, you think it's going to be a big confrontation, but it's not. Snake just shoots him. And that's him dead. And the then
classic we brought a knife to a gunfight.
Exactly. And then we cut to Cuervo is having a parade and he's driving around in his open top Cadillac, you know, just like they all drive in Cuba. You know, he's followed by his gang. Some of them are on bikes. A lot of them are on bikes. One guy's on a horse for no reason.
The guy on the horse with an Uzi. Yes. Although, sorry to cut in. I know you're trying to go fast there, but on Corvo's Cadillac convertible, was there a disco ball on the back of it during this scene? Cause it appear like when that car reappears.
I didn't notice the glitter ball until the later scene. So, like, the other bizarre thing about Cuervo's car is it has lots of decapitated doll heads all around the windshield and covering the bonnet. This is never mentioned. It's never explained. It is just a production design choice that I'm just like, it's a choice.
It is definitely a choice, and they went with it. The action scene turned into a motorbike chase, I believe.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Well, we get more Snake exposition as the bike chase is going on. So Cuervo is just giving more of Snake's biography of like, he was a gun runner and I hear he's slowing down now. And Utopia's like, it doesn't look like he's slowing down as he does a wheelie on the bike. And, so we get more of Snake's biography while the action is going on.
The amazing CG, for the motorbike jump from Kurt Russell onto the back of one of the flatbed trucks that were driving in this parade that we never saw until he jumps onto it. Where you could see that they've just cut a photo of him on the motorbike and like moved it on the frame onto this truck. It was just more amazing 90s graphics. But,
yeah.
And then he gets taken out. The best part is when Cuervo pulls out those bolos, the two balls tied on a string, and then just chucks it and chokes out Snake, and he falls off of whatever vehicle he was on, and that's what stops him.
Yeah, it is quite funny. Like, you know, Snake in this film, he's a badass, and he gets out of any given situation, but he's also like a bit of he kind of bumbles through things at the same time. You know, things happen to him that you're just like, okay. So I don't know. Maybe it kind of humanizes him, I suppose. Like the fact that he's not the kind of one man army. He's just kind of like, I got there in the end.
Yeah. But everyone else thinks that he's just like a golden god. And continuing on with the action set pieces, after falling off, he is surrounded by, I believe, four of Corvo's associates with guns. That's right. And he's like, I wasn't paying complete attention, but I think he says something to the extent of, let's make this a standoff. And then he picks up a cup off the ground and he's like, we don't shoot until this cup touches the ground. And he tosses it into the sky and then just shoots all four of them.
This is one of the scenes I genuinely love because it's the way they react to it is like, what he says is, let's play Bangkok rules. And and they react as if they know what Bangkok rules are. They're like, and they kind of back off and they're like, yeah, okay, we're taking this seriously. And then he just throws the cup up and then he just shoots them all. And then he says, draw. And it's a good gag.
Yes, that it was a great bit. That's probably the best bit in the movie, I have to say.
Yeah, definitely one of the best, yeah.
But yeah, that genuinely made me laugh, even though I knew exactly where it was going from the moment he picked the cup off the ground. Actually, no, I'll take that back. I was like, why is he picking a cup off the ground? Then I realized what was going on.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So from here, I have a gap. I think he runs into...
So he first runs into Maps to the Star Eddie in a cameo by, I suppose it's more than a cameo. I suppose Steve Buscemi is in enough of this film to count as a supporting role.
Right.
So he meets him and he says to him like, basically you need me. I'm the guy who knows his way around town. You know, it's like, even though showbiz is now dead, there's still stars and I can show you that I'm the, yeah, like, I'm the guy
you need now. Yeah.
And again, this is kind of one of those things where there's like an equivalent from the first, because it's kind of similar-ish to the cabbie character played by Ernest Borgnine in the first film. So there's a bunch of mirroring going on.
Which, again, Western motif, so it's totally passable and not bad writing.
Well, I mean, it's the same thing with Stacey Keach, is essentially the Lee Van Cleef character from the first film and everything, you know.
True. Let's see. So from there, he goes into Beverly Hills, if I'm remembering correctly, and yep, then meets...
Talisima is the character's name.
Talisima, who we don't find out until like one of the last moments she's in the movie, her name. But they're both hiding in the bushes. They see these hooded figures surrounding an ambulance or two that gets pulled in. And these are Ghostbuster-style ambulances, not like actual U.S. ambulances that you would see. I'm pretty sure they just put a repaint on the Ecto-1. And
could very well be.
And so these hooded figures, Snake's like, I'm not going to wait in the bushes. And he just walks out and he sees one and they're just staring at each other for, I would say, way too long before he realizes that someone else has come up beside him and hits him with a net that captures him.
Again, no, quite a good gag. Just Kurt Russell's reaction to like, ah, shit.
Was perfect. Like, it's weird where like this movie wants itself to be like so serious at times. And then there's just the brilliant gags, the Jaws gag, this gag, the cup gag. There's good funny moments in it, and which makes it endearing. And speaking of funny, when he comes to, or I guess he didn't get knocked out, but when we see, Talisima and Snake next, they're in a plastic surgeon's lair and a character comes out who's referred to as the plastic surgeon or the surgeon general
of Beverly Hills.
Yes. Played by Bruce Campbell, who you can't really tell because all of these people have like really terrible, plastic surgery faces going on. And some of those people weren't actors. No.
This is actually where the effects are quite good. Like the plastic surgery gone wrong makeup effects were done by makeup effects legend Rick Baker, and they're done well.
Absolutely, it's creepy to look at. It's again, my only complaint is you can't really tell that's Bruce Campbell for his 3 minutes he's on screen.
That's true.
Campbell being a good a horror action star, I guess would be a word. I don't know. Yes. Well, yeah. Also, he's in has a cameo in the spot. He's in Sam Raimi movies, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, he's basically in most Sam Raimi movies. He pops up, and obviously for any horror fans, you know, he's legendary for playing Ash. Oh, I should tell you as well, one of the fun facts I learned in the research for this episode is that Kurt Russell and Bruce Campbell share the same stunt double.
Oh, really?
Yep.
aren't they? I assumed they weren't like similar in age, but I guess similar. Oh, huh. I guess they are. And size and huh. That is an interesting fact. I never would have thought of that.
No, neither would I. And I did not realize that until I started looking into this film.
but it's, I would say this cameo, I think, hurts the worst because it's like, you bring in Bruce Campbell and it's like bringing, it's like if you were to bring Jim Carrey, 90s Jim Carrey into this movie and give him 3 minutes on screen and not give him any scene to chew. Like the most I remember him saying is, "My God, they're real," when he feels up the Talisima.
Talisima, yeah.
Because she has no breast augmentations. So that was the joke. And this is the point in my notes where I wrote, John Carpenter and or Russell are terrible at writing dialogue.
But I mean, and, like, in this movie, like, you know, John Carpenter's written some great dialogue in other films, including right. Escape from New York.
Right. So I feel like it's the Kurt Russell influence. And I mean, this is his one writing credit. So maybe he was like, okay, maybe I didn't do the best job and has shied away from writing. Cause great actor.
Maybe I should just be a cool action star.
Yeah. Also, just to keep bringing up, the Talisima was played by an Italian actress, dressed as a goth girl with a Hispanic accent and playing a Muslim from South Dakota.
Yes.
That is all you get from me. And then,
yeah, I mean, there's nothing more to say really. But you know, like, I was just like, oh, okay, this is, and then it's never really explained whether she is a Muslim convert and therefore maybe that is better, or if she's actually, if they're just going full pro wrestling where it's like, you know, Italian, Middle Eastern, it's the same, isn't it?
Yeah. True. They could have, we should give them the benefit of the doubt here. And, so they escape, because, I remember the action set piece is they gave Kurt Russell a, James Bond style blow dart, that he somehow had in his, mouth because when he was suiting up, he put it on his shoulder. So I'm assuming he reached over and pulled it out with his shoulder or from his shoulder into his mouth and then blew a dart into Bruce Campbell's brain that stunned him or something. And that cut him free. It was a comedy of errors, on the Surgeon General of Beverly Hills. And then they escape and they get to like a really heartfelt scene where it was like, where Talisima's like, this is the place where people go when they first get here and they don't know what's going on in LA and you should feel bad for these people, blah, blah, blah. And then, Snake grunts and she's like, once you figure this place out, it's not bad. And then she's immediately shot by a bunch of Asian teens in Uzi driving a Cuban car with flames on the front.
I think that was the thing that killed me about the scene, of just being like the fact that it's like, you know, that kid who's like the villain in RoboCop 2. It's like these are like 12-year-olds or something, yeah. who have just done a drive by in their flame car.
Yeah. It was as if, the kid from Temple of Doom had, randomly pulled out a submachine gun and shot Winnie just randomly throughout in the movie, and you're like, yeah, I can see that. But whereas I believe the terrible Paul McGann Doctor Who straight to TV movie came out in 1996, at least their Asian street gang member wasn't a 12-year-old child.
You had to bring that up, Brandon. That's That's right. You know, like I've talked about this on the
podcast. I dig deep.
I've talked about this on the podcast before. Along with Phantom Menace, the Doctor Who TV movie, one of the biggest disappointments of my childhood. I talk about this in the Judge Dredd episode because, again, I was a big Judge Dredd fan. I was disappointed by that too. Yeah. I don't like to think about it too much. I was so excited for, you know, I was like, oh man, I've watched Tom Baker. I've watched all this, but I'm going to get my own Doctor Who.
Yeah. Oh yeah. That's gotta be a letdown. I came for time that we don't have. I came to Doctor Who later in life with the 05 reboot.
Oh, the boot. Yeah, right. I think a lot of people came in with that, and it makes more sense.
I jumped on with David Tennant, and then, but when doing my podcast, I realized that back in the 90s, they played Doctor Who, first four, maybe five Doctors they would play on, public access in the States, and something just unlocked in my brain where, like, I was watching a black and white TV show or my dad was watching it and I was just playing, on my Game Boy. And, there were these Pepper Potts, outside of a blue box banging on the door, and then it would cut back into the interior of a spaceship. And my brain was just like, I don't understand what's going on here. why is there just random shots on the outside of this blue box? And cut in between random shots of, an elderly man and, a young girl inside of a spaceship. But eventually I figured out that was Doctor Who I was watching at a very young age. I was more of a Red Dwarf fan back then.
Oh wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
That was clutch for PBS. They would play that, but, again, this is an action movie podcast, not a sci-fi movie podcast.
Yeah, that's podcast. True. It's not the sci-fi. It's not British sci-fi podcast. As like, I mean, if I had the time, if that would be another podcast I would make. But that's not what we're doing here.
I would sign on for a Red Dwarf rewatch. Just saying.
Okay.
So, roaming pack of Asian teens kills Talisma, and then I think Steve Buscemi's character pulls up again in a car very similar to Corvo's. In retrospect, now that I think about it, but I didn't look too hard. But was that the same make, possibly model?
He does actually say to Snake that this is one of Cuervo's cars. He lets me borrow it sometimes. I'm his agent.
Oh, but he doesn't reveal he's Cuervo's agent until after he drives Snake for a little while and just like drops him off.
Yeah. I think he might reveal that it's one of Cuervo's cars when he drugs him.
Oh yes. Cause of the, oh wow. The Bond moment where the passenger side panel pops down and reveals two dart guns in the console. And then goes straight into Kurt Russell's gut and he then Snake's gut and then he passes out. Oh, but not before I have notes on this. The movie starts to get all like acid trippy, like, Easy Rider era when they did the acid in the graveyard. So for some reason our Snake gets hit with some sort of knockout poison dart thing, and yet our perspective begets trippy, and like the screen morphs and turns colors, and it was a choice. It was a choice that they made.
It was a choice. It kind of cuts back and forth between color and black and white and stuff. There's a real kind of music video visual quality to it that really reminded me of Natural Born Killers.
I didn't even, my brain just went straight to criticizing it. I didn't really think about anything that looked similar to it. But that is an apt comparison. I couldn't get past it. I was like, why, again, in a very serious movie that interjects some comedy, would our frame of reference be askew when Kurt Russell's passing out, when he wasn't, like, because one of the running themes in this movie is that because of this drug that he's been poisoned with previously, the scratch, is that he becomes fatigued. He starts like experiencing symptoms from this quote unquote poison, and which we'll get to later. But we don't see when he starts to feel woozy from that, the frame doesn't get weird on us. Like it was a very specific choice for these darts to make him go woozy and then pass out. It was beyond me. Like I couldn't handle it.
Yeah. I don't know. Like you say, it was definitely a choice. It's kind of, I don't know. There's part of me that kind of like it, because I was just like, well, this is wacky. I'm not sure it needs to be there, but you know, it's kind of fun that it is.
Well, it's whiplash. Because like we had that emotional scene with Talisma, who's like, once you figure this place out, it's not so bad. And then she immediately dies, which clearly was, I don't know if they were going for, maybe it's not clear, but they were either going for a gag, or going for an emotional hit. And then for me, it was an emotional hit because you start to relate to this character, because she's like, I come from, like, I'm here because of my religion and whatnot. And I've finally figured out how to live here. And then she just immediately dies. And, so depending on if you're a terrible person or a not as terrible person, it hits you differently, which is why I could see both. But it's just like, there's so many different tones in this movie, and it jumps from one to the other and back again. And it's hard to figure out.
I think, on my, like the other podcast that I do, New Horror Express, where we have a spinoff where we cover some of, horror's guilty pleasures of the 21st century. One of the ones we covered was, Ghosts of Mars. And, this film is campy for kind of most of it. There is the odd moment of tonal whiplash. It does not suffer from as much tonal whiplash as Ghosts of Mars, where at least in this film I feel that the whole cast know which movie they're in, which is not true of Ghosts of Mars.
That's fair. And not to be confused with John Carter's Mars. That was
yes. A bad joke. Or any of the other failed Mars movies.
Mars with Matt Damon. Was it Matt Damon?
I don't know. Yeah, that's the one that broke the streak. The Martian, the Ridley Scott Martian movie is the one successful Mars movie.
Yeah. To be fair, I like the, is it Red Planet?
Red Planet, I can never remember if that's the Brian De Palma one. There's two Mars movies that came out in 2000, Mission to Mars and Red Planet. I can never remember which one's the Brian De Palma one.
This is the Val Kilmer one, I think.
Okay.
With Tom Sizemore.
Yeah.
And Carrie Ann Moss.
Okay. Yeah.
You're right. There's two. I remember I liked one of them. But I'm not saying it was good. I'm saying it was terrible, but it was like, I still liked it.
Still enjoyed it.
It's okay. One of those bad. The director was Anthony Hoffman for that one. But yeah, sorry, sidetracked. we last left Snake when he got knocked out, and then he's now chained to a radiator in the background of a film. Or video call. Was that a video call? I couldn't understand if he was broadcasting to the world. So Corvo
he's broadcasting. Yeah, he's broadcast. No, he's not. It's not a video call. It's like he is broadcasting live to. He is talking directly to the president. He's making the speech directly to the president as if he's talking to the president. But they mentioned that he's like broadcasting on all channels. This is going all over the world. Isn't this embarrassing? So it's like his kind of party political broadcast from Corvo. Poirot and giving the big monologue about how it's not just threats. They have worked out how to control the Sword of Damocles, and he turns off the lights in Lynchburg, Virginia, which is where the White House is now.
Yes. Oh, yes, they moved the White House because of the lifelong president election. Yes.
President for life, who doesn't have a character name. He is just he's credited as president. They didn't give him a character name.
Just so Snake knows, the scientist that programmed the Sword of Damocles for them says the world code is 666 right in front of Snake as Corvo's like, take him away. And and then Corvo's like, yes, thank you. I'm not an idiot. I know what the world code is. You don't have to tell me twice. You just have to tell me in front of Snake so that he knows what the code is for later. And it's just like, I'm like, this is terrible screenwriting.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, it's good screenwriting in that everything's justified, but it's not nuanced screenwriting. You know what I mean?
That's true. But then there's not a lot of nuance in the film generally. It's like the satire in the movie is all like, oh, that's kind of funny because I see where you're going with that. But also at the same time, it's like very just on the nose. Everything is on the nose. It's like, oh yeah, so we're in Hollywood. So, you know, of course there's a skeezy guy, you know, who's the agent to everyone. And of course, you know, there's all these botched plastic surgery jobs, you know, and even the thing about like everybody thinking he's taller or stuff like that. Oh, it's a decent gag, but it's an obvious gag at the same time. You know, like everything's kind of obvious in the film. I don't hate it for that because I still kind of find it funny despite that of being like, yeah, it's kind of on the nose, but I'll go with it.
Yeah, you're right. It's on the nose and it's expected, but it doesn't it does attract, but it's not like it doesn't make it unwatchable. It's just very, it feels like it wants to be smarter than it is, but then it's trying to be everything. It's trying to be smart. It's trying to be satirical. It's trying to be meta in some ways.
Yes.
It wants you to break the fourth wall, but it also doesn't want you to experience the fourth wall break. And again, they don't understand how California or Los Angeles is laid out, even though they live there.
I was going to say, that's one of the weirdest aspects of the film. Like, I don't understand how LA is laid out. So it doesn't really affect me because I'm not like watching it with that eye. But the weird thing to me is I know that Carpenter's a lifelong Los Angelino, you know, so like if anybody should know,
it's John Carpenter. Yeah. It's like, it is a large area that takes a while to travel across, even when there's no traffic, and like suddenly they're just in random areas within it that are nowhere near each other, and it's just and there's some giant sewer system that underneath it all that connects it for some reason, because we live in the Ninja Turtles world, is what it is. So getting back on track,
we're going to play basketball. That's where we're at.
Oh my word. There's a basketball death game. I assume they were in the Rose Bowl. I don't know what stadium that was supposed to be because it was an open air stadium with no roof.
LA Coliseum, I think.
Oh, was that LA Coliseum? That makes more sense. Given that they were doing a Gladiator Coliseum type reference.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure they filmed in the LA Coliseum, like in the behind scenes documentary I watched. That's what they were saying.
Oh, that makes it cooler. it did look familiar to me. I couldn't place it because they covered the home team on the scoreboard. It just said guest. Because it looked like they were filming at like a community college football stadium to me. My giant all caps note here is basketball death game. Who the fuck wrote this? So Snake is put into a basketball death game where he has to shoot five baskets within 10 seconds of scoring each basket to make a total of 10 points. And you have to shoot it on opposite. You have to make the basket on opposite ends of the court. As someone who doesn't play a lot of basketball, I don't know if that's a normal game that people play, but as he makes the first one pretty easy, then as it goes on, it gets harder and he keeps getting closer and closer to the shot clock running out. And finally on the last one, the shot clock runs out just as he hucks the ball from 3/4 of the way across the court and it goes straight in. So he gets the final shot. And there's random additions of slow-mo to this to add tension to the scene, I assume was the intent.
Yes.
When in fact it just makes the scene A, longer and, B, more painful to watch. in my opinion, I don't know how you felt about that.
Okay. So like, again, we're in kind of mirroring territory as well. Cause I think like this is supposed to mirror the wrestling match in the original, which is way cooler. I do like part of me kind of enjoys this scene, partly because of the research and because I watched the behind the scenes documentary and the fact that, I think this scene was originally Kurt Russell's idea and then he workshopped it with, John Carpenter. And the thing that makes me appreciate this scene is Kurt Russell, like apparently there was something like 50 shooting days before they shot this scene and he was training on the basketball court on the night of each shooting day. And, he made all these shots. And like, you know, there's like a layup and there's like a 3-point shot. There's a half court shot and there's the big full court lob. And the fact that he put so much energy into this and he actually made all of those shots does actually make me kind of appreciate the scene, even though it's completely ridiculous.
Did he actually make the final shot? Because
he made the full court lob. Yeah.
Okay, that's more impressive because it almost looked a little CG, but it never went out of frame. So I guess that was a
no. He trained the whole shoot for this moment and to make all of those shots for real. And he even made the full court lob. Although apparently it took them all night to film this scene, you know, he failed the shots multiple times, but he did make it.
Yeah. So essentially Russell was, he was 10 to 15 years ahead of, those YouTube channels where people just make all those trick shots. Have you seen? It would be funnier had I actually remembered what the actual name of the channel is where they make all those crazy trick shots. But I mean, it is 2013 in the movie. Someone could have uploaded this to dystopian YouTube and made some money. It makes it more endearing because it did look like he was actually doing it. But at the same time, why? Why? I know it's a dystopia. I know it was like in Star Wars where the movies rhyme with each other, but, just to make you remember the prequels again. But it was just to see Kurt Russell pick up the basketball and start dribbling towards the hoop to do a layup in slow-mo. My brain broke.
I mean, to be fair, again, you know, like, he did well, you know, time Kurt Russell was 45, you know, like, I mean, I'll be, you know, I like, I don't think I can do a layup now, never mind in 9 years' time.
That's fair. But, I mean, yes, the feat of him doing it, that I'm not denying, that was great. But for the character of Snake. Oh, and then Corvo still wants him killed, even though he beat the death challenge. So, then an aftershock happens, so he can't snipe him from the court. And
then his second shot is thrown off by Utopia, who is slowly going off Cuervo's charms.
Yes, and falling in love with Snake, because why wouldn't she?
Yeah. She kind of does, which kind of makes it weird. Like, so maybe it's just the way she plays it. Maybe in the original script, it doesn't like read like that of like her, like kind of, lusting for, Snake, because like apparently Kurt Russell had suggested the role to Kate Hudson, his stepdaughter. Maybe it just read differently on the script or, you know, hopefully.
I mean, if Kate Hudson had taken the role, would she have eventually gone on to become the, Duchess of, where is this in my notes? I wrote it down. No, I can't find it. The actress who played Utopia is now, she is a countess or a duchess or something. Oh, where are you?
So she, like, the actress is A.G. Langer, who at the time was, known for being in that show, that Claire Danes was in, My So-Called Life.
Right.
Yeah. And,
she is now the Countess of Devon.
Okay.
Yeah. didn't know that. That was a weird fact.
Weird.
She married Lord Courtenay.
Okay. Well, who knows? Who knows what would have become of Kate Hudson if she had taken up this role? She did not. She turned the role down.
Thankfully, because that would have been even weirder. Like, I mean, maybe it was parental vibes that she was giving off or seeking from him, but it got a little weird.
Yep. Maybe Kate Hudson would have played it differently. Maybe it would have been a more kind of fatherly relationship. I assume so.
We can only hope. So was this where? Was this where the shootout happens again, and then he actually gets his hands on the Sword of Damocles?
That is correct. And then he makes a sewer escape, and
she tries to go with him.
Utopia tries to go with him. Because one of his missions was to kill Utopia. He can't kill Utopia, tells her to run away. But then as that's happening, Snake is shot by Maps to the Stars, Eddie, and Eddie retrieves the box. And then the roof of the sewer kind of caves in, and Snake is flushed away, and Eddie and Utopia head back upwards to the surface.
And then Snake gets flushed out and sees Peter Fonda again.
Whose character, like, I don't know if you caught this, right? So Peter Fonda's character is credited as Pipeline. Do we ever get his character name in the movie itself? Because I don't remember him ever saying his name, and I don't remember anybody else saying his name.
I do not remember him saying his name either. And I was also waiting, because apparently in the group of surfers from the beginning of the movie, or when he first gets to LA, apparently Breckenmeyer. Yeah.
All right. Yeah.
He's one of the surfers.
That's amazing.
So I figured he was going to come back with Peter Fonda, but he did not. But yeah, I don't recall him saying the name or the word pipeline. Unless it was in the intro, he's like, "Yeah, my name is Pipeline Man," and I just thought he was talking about surfing or something.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess we'll have to go back and do that. But he's out there, and there's a tsunami aftershock coming, or a tsunami coming from the aftershocks that just happened, that he's going to surf. And he gives Snake a surfboard as well. And I'm at a loss again, just because he has three surfboards on his like dune buggy vehicle, like his road warrior dune buggy, and he gives one to Snake. But his car is just in this valley where the tsunami is coming that he's going to surf. And why would you leave? Like, does he not care about the car? He knows the tsunami is coming and he's going to surf it.
Yep. Apparently he doesn't care about the car. Apparently he just cares about catching this wave, dude.
And so Steve Buscemi's character, Eddie?
Maps to the Stars Eddie is his character.
Is tasked with finding Snake's body because he told Corvo that he shot him dead. And as he's driving along the side of the road, when the tsunami's coming, that Snake and Pipeline are surfing together. Kurt Russell on a tsunami, a wave of the tsunami while surfing, catches up to a speeding car and jumps onto Eddie's car and then knocks him out and takes him over.
I think in terms of like, if people know one thing about this movie, I feel like it's this scene. And it, obviously it's the scene that's used to kind of ridicule it the most. But there's something gloriously good mad about this scene. I think it's like the interaction of like the kind of the nod of respect that like Peter Fonda and, Snake give each other. I'm not sure they quite give each other a kind of high five, but there's like a kind of, kind of pump
fist. There's definitely the nod.
There's a definite nod, and it's a clear nod of respect. And it's also, so that makes it hilarious. The terrible CGI obviously makes it hilarious as well. And Steve Buscemi's reaction, his face, also makes it hilarious.
That was amazing. And then I think at one point while they're surfing the tsunami, you could just see like, it looked like they were on one of those like wave machines that you can surf on. And then there's just a green screen on the other side of them, or possibly blue screen since it was still, no, it was water. So it would have been a green screen. But yeah, it's just like, it's hilariously terrible. And it is a great scene that you need to watch if you've not seen this movie. And so I don't remember how, but he knocks out, or he gets control of the car, and then I think Eddie takes him to Hershey, which I assumed the entire time like the chocolate company Hershey. No, it's H-E-R-S-H-E, because it's a character named Carjack who is a transgender woman. And the entire time during the scene where Snake is feeling up her crotch to grab the gun that she has hidden there, I was like, is this positive LGBTQ representation or not?
I don't know. For one thing, like, I have kind of complicated feelings of like talking about this scene in terms of like, I am probably not best placed to tell whether it's positive or not as a cisgendered straight white male. Exactly. So like, that's one thing. On the other thing, I don't find it offensive in that like it seems to come from a good place, but then also her character name is basically he/she, and also
yeah,
there's the kind of
the
problematic element of
the Ace Ventura
like misgenders her deliberately a bunch of times, and it's played for laughs.
Yep, it's the Einhorn is a man scene from Ace Ventura, essentially.
Yeah.
Except a little bit toned down. But yeah, so Hershey Carjack, the voice modulation, I would also say, was slightly problematic. Because it's a woman playing, or it's a cis woman playing Hershey.
Yes, it is. It's Pam Grier. We should mention it's the blaxploitation legend that is Pam Grier playing.
And they modulate her voice to be like, it's not even manly. It just sounds like she's talking through a voice distorter. Hershey helps, or Hershey convinces, or Snake convinces Hershey to take down Corvo with him, and he'll get them pardons or something.
I was just going to say one more thing on what you made the kind of Ace Ventura comparison. I would say that it is better than Ace Ventura.
Yes.
Because, Snake is not repulsed by it. Snake right. seems fine with it. It's just that he's Snake's being Snake, and he likes taking the piss out of everyone. And then, he's doing that by still calling her Carjack because he knows mm-hmm. it annoys her, which is problematic for sure. But I don't think it comes from a place of malice or, it's not. It doesn't have that same vibe of we're laughing at this because that is disgusting and appalling, which right. is very much the vibe you get in the Ace Ventura scene, which makes that so much more kind of ugh.
Yeah. It's tough to go back and watch that movie because 90% of it comedy gold. And then it's just, then you get there and you're like, the 90s when jokes on Friends were 10% to 25% homophobia. And, the 90s, welcome back to the 90s. This is what we talk about on our podcasts. Thank you for clarifying that. It is better than the representation in Ace Ventura. So he convinces Hershey, and Eddie either has flipped sides or is convinced to flip sides at this point, to take down Corvo. And
Eddie is basically on whatever side he thinks is going to win, as very much his character trait.
And he's like, we could get a helicopter and get off the island and whatever. By this point, I was just like, this is killing my brain.
This is one scene as well where, again, it's kind of like Snake is this brilliant survivor, but also a bit of an idiot, because both Eddie and Hershey clarify that the virus that he's been injected with is bullshit. It's a sham virus. Yep. And he completely just skates by that and doesn't take that information in at all until they're obviously the final reveal where it's revealed, oh, it's a sham virus. And then he's surprised at the end. It's like, you were told that 15 told that minutes twice. Ago.
Yeah. And on top of that, it's just like, he didn't even consider it. He was just like, I guess if you're told you have a poison in your body and you feel the effects of it, you're going to keep going and try to get the cure if you can in time. But at the same time, it's like, they told you point blank, that's not a real thing. So their plan is, one of, Hershey's men, says, if the winds are right, we can get to Corvo's new hideout or wherever they are. So it cuts to them on top of the Hollywood sign, or on the Hollywood Hills by the Hollywood sign, with hang gliders. They hang glide from the Hollywood sign to Corvo's hideout, which is implied to be Disneyland, I believe.
Yes, and they did try to film at Disneyland and ask for permission, and Disney refused that permission and said no. So they were naturally, we're just going to make something like Disneyland, fuck you.
Yeah, which Disney made the right choice. And I want to get to my next joke, but the CG for the hang gliding, I think that was, we said the submarine is the worst in the movie. The hang gliding is up there.
Oh yeah. It's terrible. I noted that in my notes as well, of just how terrible the CGI is when they first launch off that building. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's awful.
or any wide shot where it just looks like it looks like the bat creature from Gremlins 2 is flying around.
Oh yeah.
But they're hang gliders. I wrote, what is this, Batman Forever? Because of the bad CG. So I did some math. I did some research. Hang gliders are able to fly up to 100 miles, sometimes. Longest trip is somewhere around 200 to 400 miles, or, sorry, I didn't convert that for you. They could go about 300 kilometers or so.
Oh, no, it's fine. It's fine. Britain's weird. We're the one European country that uses miles. So it's all good.
Oh, perfect. I should have remembered that from the song. So the Hollywood sign is about 1,500 feet in elevation. And they hang glide 34 miles from the Hollywood sign to the center of Disneyland, Main Street Disneyland, or whatever they called it in this.
The Happy Kingdom is called in this film.
Happy Kingdom, yes. So I don't know about you, but given there's a ton of buildings in the way, and the Hollywood Hills aren't too high. I don't think they could make it 34 miles on a hang glider, even with the right weather conditions.
Probably not. No.
But I guess in the 2013 Utopia of Los Angeles.
Yeah, everything's been flattened, and you know, there's been lots of earthquakes and stuff like that, and you know, everything's been kind of destroyed. So in the 2013 hellscape, presumably it's all right. You know, like as is often mentioned on this podcast, if we get too hung up on logic, we'll be here all day.
That's true. And especially since we're down to the final fight between Snake and Corvo, which I had zero notes for. I don't know if you had anything on that.
I just put Corvo versus Snake fist fight while battle rages.
There was a fist fight, yes. I forgot about that.
Yeah. So they're just having a fist fight. And one of the things we should probably mention is that Hershey's gang is one of the gang is John Carpenter's regular stunt coordinator, Jeff Amada, who is the one who talks about the Nightwind. Like, in my notes, I put Jeff Amada gibbering about Nightwind. He goes on about Dark Shadows, and he has the weirdest monologue in the movie. But anyway, he's there. And also henchman legend Al Leong, it's always fun to see Al Leong in anything. So he's also one of the Asian gang that Hershey is the leader of.
Which was a weird gang to be led by Hershey, but it works.
Yeah, Asian gang led by black women. It's very inclusive. It's very
the one real diverse part of LA, apparently. Dystopia 2013 LA. So my next note is when they're escaping on a helicopter, I think the whole gang, Hershey and the gang in the back of the helicopter?
Snake grabs Utopia. Like, they all get into the helicopter. Snake is in the front and with Utopia, and then Map to the Stars, Eddie gets in the helicopter, Hershey gets in the helicopter, Al Leong character gets in the helicopter, Jeff Amada gets in the helicopter, and I think one other Asian henchman gets in it. Like, there's a lot of the, to the extent where I was like, it's like a kind of clown car thing where I was like, how many people are in this helicopter?
They were crammed in the back of that helicopter, which I probably should have had. I might have had a bench seat, but it probably would have had two bucket seats in the back there. And the both sides were wide open for some reason. Well, the reason was because Corvo pulls out an RPG. Or a 2013 dystopian rocket propelled grenade and launches it straight at the open sides of the helicopter and makes it incinerating everyone in the back seats.
But what makes this scene extra hilarious is Cuervo does this after being shot in the gut by Maps to the Stars Eddie.
Oh, because Maps to the Stars Eddie falls out of the helicopter as it's taking off.
Yes, Maps to the Stars Eddie like shoots Cuervo and is very pleased with himself, like, "Hey, I killed Cuervo!" And then Cuervo is like doesn't react to being shot at all. And then still shoots the rocket off, and then just collapses dead straight after that. And then Maps to the Star Eddie, like, as the rocket's kind of coming in, just kind of falls off the helicopter. And like you say, everyone else in the back of the helicopter gets completely incinerated, just leaving Utopia and Snake as the only survivors.
You see Snake remember that he's wearing a heat-proof jacket and, leather getup, so he pops the collar up a little bit as it's exploding in the back, and that prevents the entire cockpit and somehow Utopia from being burned alive by the explosive in the back of the cockpit.
We just don't know about that wacky 2013 science, you know, like there's many things happened in 2013.
It's a magical exploding grenade before it fills the entire or it might not have been a grenade, given that the explosion. But yeah, it was just, I was like, she should be more burned, because there's still fire in the back of the cockpit as they're flying away. That's the other thing. As they fly from Orange County, which was lumped in with L.A. When it was earthquaked away, and all the way back to their starting point, the entire time the helicopter's on fire, and they eventually make it back to the starting point of our adventure, and Snake pushes Utopia out of the helicopter so she could try to make a run for it, and he puts a control device for the Sword of Damocles in her jacket, or so we're led to believe. And then he dies in a fiery crash. The end. No, he,
or is it? Or are you just making that up, Brandon?
I'm making that part up. But you don't see him escape the crash, again, for good reason. And suddenly, as all the president and everyone that sent him on this mission come out to check the fiery rebel, he just walks out of the thing unharmed, and you're like, okay, I guess he has the magic jacket cape thing going on, and I wrote that down until a little bit further on. I don't really have a good detailed explanation of what happens next. I think the president asks for the sword.
Yeah, so after he gets off the helicopter, as we've discussed, he's told that the virus, Platoxin 7, is actually not a deadly virus. It's just a fast-acting flu, which, again, leads to kind of logistical questions of, like, surely there was a better way to blackmail this man rather than handicap him by making him do this mission while having the flu. But we probably shouldn't get into that. And then, he hands over the Sword of Damocles to the president. But then Stacy Keach's character is like, hey, hold on, wait a second. Before the president basically orders Utopia to be executed right there on the spot, just shot dead. And but Stacy Keach is like, no, wait a second, I think something's up here. So he gets the other Sword of Damocles controller, because there was two, a kind of duplicate one that was made by Maps to the Stars Eddie, which we didn't mention, but that's what, and he was planning to do like a kind of switcheroo, which we were led to believe he actually did do. And so that's that. And then basically immediately there is a podium that comes out of nowhere, so the president can do a speech on live network government news that apparently is always happening at all times. And he basically tells off this kind of coalition of Latin American countries that are apparently about to attack in 4 minutes, that include Brazil, Cuba, Mexico, I think some other Latin American, South American, Central American countries are mentioned, but they were the main ones that are mentioned. And he says, back off now or I will, turn off all the power, with my, with the device. That it can turn off all the power but then he types in the code that will turn off all the power in Brazil, Mexico, Cuba, whatever. And it doesn't work. It's just Mapped to the Stars, Eddie's narration of like, welcome to Hollywood, all that kind of stuff. And then it cuts back to Snake and he's got the actual real controller, but the president is furious and he tells the men to execute Snake, and on Stacey Keach's orders, they shoot Snake. And just like earlier, they really should have seen this coming. He plays the old hologram trick that was played on him right back at the start of the movie. And that's what happens. And then he types in the 666 world code that was said out loud to him slightly earlier on in the film. And he turns off all the power in all the world. And we end on a meta sting where Snake Plissken looks directly in the camera. It cuts to black and he says, welcome to the human race. And then credits.
Brava. Like, The last 3 minutes are just a brilliant example of the screenwriting in this movie, with every Chekhov's gun that was introduced is paid off, if not for a second time. And it's just like all the exposition dump from the front of the movie makes it into the back end of like, oh, you had the bulletproof or the fireproof jacket. Oh, you had the hologram that we used, and oh, the number that he whispered in front of you, or not whispered, blatantly said in front of you, is back. The dots with the mini CD player with a nail polish red dot on it somehow came back into play, and it was just like they really had to just tie literally everything back into that final reveal.
Yeah, it's like, to be fair, there is something very amusing about it. It kind of does end like a stand-up routine. It's like, like it's all been
the producer
throughout the show, and then it's just a flurry of callbacks, and you're just like, yeah. Oh, I remember that. Oh, I see what you did there.
Another bait and switch. Oh, the virus wasn't real. Oh, yeah. It was just like,
The fact that Eddie and Hershey both say, like, nah, that virus is bullshit. Like, that really spoils that reveal.
But at the same time, it makes the logic jump so that Snake would, like, had he needed a cure, he would have still been there. He wouldn't have been the hologram.
Yeah, that's true.
So logically, I think everything makes sense for the payoff. It's just they really just had to use literally everything they introduced very overtly and then pay it off right at the end there.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was Escape from LA.
That was Escape from LA. But that was just our thoughts on Escape from LA. If you are listening, tell us what you thought. You can always hit us up on @90sall, or you can always, even better, rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, wherever you're listening to your podcasts. And if you can make those reviews 5 stars, that would be really good, because basically if you don't make your review 5 stars, it upsets the podcast algorithm gods, and as podcasters we all have to obey the world of the podcast algorithm gods, and upsetting them is you know, we shouldn't do that. So five stars, people, five stars. So
think of it as an Amazon review. Five stars all the way.
Five stars all the way.
Or that Uber driver that didn't say anything the entire ride.
So, before we head on out, it just leaves me to thank very much my co-host, Brandon from the Namely 90s podcast. If you want to give any final thoughts on the film, Brandon, and also please do plug away your podcast.
I gave this movie a lot of criticism, but it was, by the time my brain broke halfway through, it was just a fun ride to the end. Like I said before, I watched this movie I've seen this movie a few times, and every time by the end, you're enjoying all of those payoffs in that final second. And, it's not a cinematic masterpiece, but it is a 90s action movie, and there's nothing better than that. So you can find me on my comedy nostalgia podcast, a co-host with one of my childhood best friends called Namely 90s, where each week we look back at a month and a year in the 1990s. And you can head to namely90s.com/listen to find your favorite platform to listen to us on, and join us over on Twitter and Instagram at namely90s with a 90s. I also, we didn't mention this, but I also do a wine edutainment YouTube series called Rewind with B. Schwitty, which you can find over at youtube.com/rewindshow, where I do crazy wine pairings, informational episodes, and reviews. And if you just want to yell at me directly on Twitter about how badly I treated Escape from LA, you can find me at B. Schwitty. That's BSCHWITTY.
Excellent. And I recommend people do all of those things, apart from shouting to you about how we've treated Escape from LA, because I think people listening will recognize that both of us, despite kind of shitting on this film, feel that it is an enjoyable film, and it is a fun ride. And Kurt, you know, I could just, even in the most terrible film, I could watch Kurt Russell being Snake Plissken all day. Absolutely. So yes, there's a lot of terrible aspects to this movie. Yes, it's kind of ridiculous. Yes, it has some of the worst CGI you will ever see in your life. But even with that, it's still pretty good fun. And absolutely. Yeah, I think we should end it on that note. And well done, Kurt. And well done, kind of, John Carpenter, for giving us this enjoyable, if completely ridiculous film. But that's all for this time. Please do join us next time when we will be talking about Breakdown. But until then, see ya.